Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, February 22nd, 2019. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, well, I lied. I guess we are live to tape. Why? Because it's the final day of our vacation. Lamenting, enjoying the perhaps disconnection that we were able to achieve from the daily grind. Lamenting it's winding down, but gearing up to deal with the absolute crap show that is undoubtedly happening. Perhaps maybe with new people entering the Democratic race this week. Who knows? In the meantime, have an interview with one of the authors of a fascinating book based on, or I should say, a book based on fascinating research. It's called Deep Roots: How Slavery Still Shapes Southern Politics. I'm going to be talking to Professor Matthew Blackwell. Wrote this book with Avedit Acharya and Maya Sen. Really interesting. I mean, just this interview recorded about a week or so ago, and some of the stuff blew my mind. And I've been thinking about it in the days since we recorded it, and I imagine through this whole week. This is one I'm going to go back and listen to. And I rarely do that because I'm so sick of me. But this is one that I think I'm going to listen to, not even again. I generally don't even listen. I generally can't even remember, like, who I've interviewed, like 2 days earlier. That's how scrambled things get before we go on vacation. But just a reminder, this program relies on the support of its members. You can support this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Sign up. You will get extra content virtually every day. In fact, this very day, members will be listening to a deep archive cut picked out by Brendan. We actually allowed producer Brendan to go down, run around in the vault down in the sub-basement of Majority Report headquarters. This is three levels below where we store the food in the commissary. And Brendan went down there and came back up with a bunch of reel-to-reel tapes. And then he wanted to just go down there. He was begging me to let him camp out down there. He wanted to bring a tent and just stay down there for like a couple of days.
Have a sleepover.
Have a sleepover, vacation. And, you know, sometimes when you say no to Brendan, he just gets so angry. And stamps his feet. And, yeah.
Ornery.
Really, yeah. But nevertheless.
Soaking around.
Nevertheless, soaking. That's why we let him choose.
My snuff films are down there. You can't be down there too long.
Don't want him playing around with that stuff. So stick around if you're a member. If not, go to jointhemajorityreport.com right now, and you will have access after you sign up. And remember, if you you can't afford the membership, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We never turn anyone away because of money. Check that out. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, Matthew Blackwell.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Matthew Blackwell. He is Associate Professor of Government at Harvard University, also one of the co-authors of Deep Roots, How Slavery Still Shapes Southern Politics, with Avedit Chiara and Maya Sen. Matthew, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's just start with the mission of the book was to answer the question, why is the United States particularly conservative on the issue of race, or why are there differing parts of the United States that seem to be? Was that basically it?
Yeah, I think we were kind of thinking about how to wrap our heads around the fact that, you know, of the advanced industrialized countries, the United States is kind of an outlier in terms of the conservativeness, and in particular that we have this kind of one region in the country that has historically been and continues to be fairly conservative, and that's the South. And, you know, it doesn't take a lot to recognize that the South also has kind of an intense history of things like slavery and racialized violence and things like that. And we kind of were setting out to think about, well, could we kind of systematically think about how those two things are linked? Is there some deep historical reason, not just about, you know, candidates and polls and you know, campaign advertisements, but there's something deeper in the history of America that kind of has led to the broad political cultures that we see in the United States.
Implied in that is that our politics are somewhat are racialized issue. I mean, political issues that are not necessarily on their face racial, in fact, are to some degree.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's evidence, you know, not just in our book, but in elsewhere in political science that kind of shows how it's the case that, you know, when we think about redistribution in this country, a lot of people tend to think about, you know, where is the money going to come from and who is it going to go to? And the notions of, you know, the from and to tend to get caught up in a lot of ideas about race and racial groups. And so the idea that the kind of redistribution itself, the kind of the core, maybe the cornerstone political issue in the United States, gets wrapped up in, you know, are the groups that are perceived to go into beginning this redistribution deserving of that in some way? And when those groups kind of, when that kind of thinking latches onto race as one of these groups, it can really shape how people think about redistribution and really shape a lot of people's opposition to redistribution, even in times when it would perhaps even help their own personal interests.
And so you set out to sort of answer this question as to why there's this type of divergence. What is, I mean, just define for us this notion of behavioral path dependence. What for lay people, what does that mean?
Yeah, so the basic idea behind this behavioral path dependence is the idea that you know, regions or areas of the country that have certain kinds of institutions, be they economic institutions or political institutions or some combination of the two, those institutions can kind of set different localities down a path in the way and shape the kind of the behaviors and the beliefs and the actions of the people that live in those areas. And those kinds of behaviors and actions and beliefs can outlast the initial institutions that kind of the beliefs are responding to. So, you know, we can see this sometimes where it's no longer necessarily just reacting to the environment, but now those beliefs kind of take on a life of their own, even though they don't necessarily have any place in the current kind of institutional structure. And so we are kind of thinking about that in the context of slavery itself in the South, and how the kind of a lot of beliefs and attitudes that were built up in response to slavery, and especially in response to its aftermath, you can kind of see the incentives for why they were developed at the time that they were developed. But what we show is that those things tend to outlast all of those institutions by a long way, even after things like slavery, Jim Crow, and have been, you know, formally abolished in the South. We still see some kind of lingering behaviors and attitudes from those eras in these localities.
And you know, this is sort of, I guess, I mean, there's like a parallel concept, right, in psychology and within the context of family. I mean, just for instance, you know, that my great grandparents, you know, were very, very uptight about, you know, all of us having our passports because they had an experience where they had to get out of Germany rather quickly. Or Depression era folks being, you know, concerned about money. And this is passed down generation to generation, three or four generations later, you can still have people who are really uptight about money or about their passports. I mean, it's somewhat analogous to that on some level.
Yeah. And so, I mean, if you think about, you know, and obviously some of that might be genetic about the variations in people, but we also have certain issues where, you know, it's going to be the case that, you know, the way that you come to view the world is somehow shaped by the world around you as you're growing up, this kind of idea of childhood socialization, that, you know, the way that your family talks about money, for instance, can shape the way that you're going to view money as an adult, or the way that, you know, in our instance, it's the way that race is discussed, the way that race is contextualized, the way that people talk about, you know, kind of interracial relationships, you know, all of those things can't impact the way that you think about race moving forward. And even if the kind of there's a change in the context of race, you know, obviously the context of race in the 1940s in the U.S. South is very different than the context today. I mean, those are just different time periods with different kind of levels of, say, you know, obvious institutional racism. But it may still shape the way you think about it and the kind of where you fall along the spectrum in terms of, you know, having different views about race today.
Okay, so you have this theory that that our politics today, not totally but largely, when we look at these maps, and I think maybe by now people have seen sort of these overlay maps that in some extent come out of your research here, but that things that happened, that the way that the institution of slavery grew in the United States is predictive of basically how you'd vote today.
Yeah.
Like, if that's the theory, then what? Just tell us the cities that you decided to look at and why those two were sort of the way to test this theory.
Yeah, so the kind of two example cities that we kind of focus on, especially in the book, are kind of evocative of the kind of two regions of the South broadly. And the first is that we talk about is in terms of is Greenwood, Mississippi, and that's a place where, you know, it's at one point, you know, there's a sign in the outskirts of town that says Greenwood, cotton capital of the world. And it was just a kind of a powerhouse in terms of cotton productivity in the late 19th and early 20th century. And it was real, real kind of embedded in the Mississippi Delta and all of those things. And that has a kind of large African-American population that's a remnant of that, you know, to some extent a remnant of that era. And so we see this as one of these places that was kind of deep in the heart of the kind of the slave culture and the enslaved areas of the South. And we compare that to Asheville, North Carolina, where an area that is kind of in the upcountry, that is really rugged area, has a certain perception today, but it was never a good place for growing cotton in the 19th century, and never had a serious foothold of slavery back in the pre-Civil War era. And we kind of contrast these two places because, you know, neither are particularly, you know, neither of these places are particularly liberal. Both are, we would, I think, you know, generally say are conservative relative to the rest of the country. But it's certainly the case that the difference between the politics of these two areas is pretty dramatic today. And one of the in Greenwood is still extremely conservative. You know, we estimate that very, very few white people that live in the county that, that Greenwood is in voted for Barack Obama in 2008, for instance. Whereas we you know, something like 40 to 50% of the people that, that in Asheville, the whites in Asheville voted for Barack Obama. And this difference we're attributing in part to the kind of the historical development of slavery in these two areas, the fact that Greenwood had this massive infrastructure built around slavery, and in its aftermath, kind of the Reconstruction period, you also had things like sharecropping and things like that that kind of grew up in place of it. And Asheville never had that same kind of infrastructure in place, and never had the need for the kind of racialized politics that became some of the defining characteristics of places like Greenwood in the late 19th and early 20th century.
So now let me just go back, because you say both are relatively conservative. You're talking relatively conservative to the rest of the country?
To the rest of the country. Yeah, so, these are, I mean, one thing to keep in mind is that we, you know, partially that's because we're just looking at, you know, whites in general are conservative relative to the rest of the country. You know, nationally across all races, whites are more conservative. But also just because, you know, the South, even if you look at whites, the whites in the South are a little bit more conservative than whites generally. And that's partially because there aren't a lot of big cities in the South compared to the North, where you have like large clusters of kind of urban young. Folks that would make the North and non-South so much more liberal than the South.
So in terms of saying that Asheville is conservative as well as Greenwood, there's a matter of degree, and Asheville is relatively conservative to, say, I don't know, Brooklyn or something like that, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. You would never say that Asheville is necessarily the same as like a place like Brooklyn or, you know, like Cambridge, Massachusetts or something like that, but it's certainly relative to other cities in the South, is pretty liberal.
So the primary difference in terms if you look at the voting outcomes, let's say in 5 years ago, you guys trace back to the existence of slavery as a central defining characteristic of the locale at that time? Like, what is the threshold that in your research determines whether Asheville follows Asheville's path versus Greenwood follows Greenwood's path? Like, you know, what constitutes critical mass for that difference?
It's one thing that's kind of interesting about, at least in the time period that we're looking at, and it could change over time, but at least at the time period we're looking at, we actually see a fairly linear relationship between, you know, what proportion, you know, what was the relative number of enslaved African Americans versus whites in a county in 1860, right? And the kind of propensity to vote for the Republican Party or to hold more racially conservative views, like that relationship is fairly linear. So you get, you know, as you increase the proportion enslaved in 1860, you just see an increase in the conservative voting. There doesn't seem to be, and again, this might change over time, but there doesn't seem to be a real threshold for that. Or there's like these kinds of counties and those kinds of counties. I mean, we do see, you can break it out by something like, you know, kind of whether or not someplace had, you know, less than 25% and greater than 25% enslaved. And you can see differences there. But something that's interesting about it is that it does seem to scale in this way, so that it just, you know, the denser it was in the antebellum period, the kind of the more conservative the politics are today. And we think that reflects the kind of what the incentives that people were responding to at the time about slavery, and how those things, how important it was to the area at the time, kind of scales in how many or how dense the slavery was in that period.
That's sort of amazing that it's one-to-one. Well, I don't know if it's exactly one-to-one, but it's literally that sort of that there are gradations, that you don't need a critical mass that it really is just a function of just how conservative you get was really just how... Explain to me just what you mean by proportion of slave enslaved people in the county. Does that mean the total number the total number of in the population who were slaves? So if you had 90%, does that mean that like literally if there's 100 people in that county, obviously there's more, but 100 people in that county, 90 of them are slaves and 10 of them are in control?
Yeah, so there were some counties in the – that's correct. So when we're looking at – when we say proportion slavery, yeah, we mean the total number of enslaved people in the county divided by the total number of people. And you can measure that a lot of different ways, and we've done that work. But yes, and so there are these places that, you know that for every one white person, there were nine enslaved African Americans. And, you know, just some parts of the Mississippi Delta were just – it is overwhelming to see the kind of – the way that the demographics and the, you know, the economic conditions and the terribleness of the institution is kind of overwhelming. Most people don't think about it in terms of how we tend to think of slavery as, oh, you know, the South had slavery, but really there was a lot of variation. Some places had basically no slaves, and some places had massive numbers where, again, it was like 9 to 1.
Oh, it was literally 9 to 1 in some areas. And so this is how you get that disparity within the context of a broader South that is pro the institution of slavery, but it's the proximity to the practice of slavery, I guess, that is the driving factor here.
Yeah, and we find one of the reasons for that we find is that it's actually not just when slavery existed, but actually when slavery went away. So after emancipation, after the Civil War, that the places that relied on slavery the most, that had the most slaves, that, you know, in fact, where the whites were outnumbered the most, kind of once the African Americans were free, these were places that their reaction to emancipation was incredibly harsh, and they tried to enact all kinds of terrible kind of Jim Crow style laws and these things called black codes to try to constrain and restrict the mobility of African Americans in that period, and all kinds of economic institutions to react to the emancipation that were directly a function of them trying to recreate the kind of economic system that they had under slavery. And so that reaction is going to scale kind of with how dependent you are as a local area on slavery.
Wow. Okay. So the reaction is what creates the sort of the biggest institutions. Are there examples of, and I want to talk about how that translates into, you know, sort of, I guess, attitudes. But as you say that if you have the highest concentration of slaves to non-slaves, to presumably their, you know, their owners or those who are sort of like enabling their owners. And that you can see that in voting patterns 240 years later, I mean, almost, right? Or 200 years later, or I guess maybe closer to 180, but what... How does that match up in terms of figures? Is that because you had a lot of former slaves leave the area, or I mean, how does that translate? Or are you looking at the granular numbers, not the results from the county, but how the white population voted?
Yeah, so that's the key thing here, which is actually kind of is interesting to look at, because if you look at a map of how the South votes and superpose it on one of these maps of the density of slavery, what you'll see from it is it looks like that the former Black Belt, the Cotton Belt that kind of goes down through the southern states, the Deep South, if you look at that area now on you know, kind of the red blue typical maps you see on TV and things, that's actually pretty deep blue. And the reason for that is the former slave areas also happen to be places where they're not happen to be, but as a direct consequence of this, are places where there are relatively dense populations of African Americans today. And so you do see that if you just look at the kind of the vote, it looks like those areas are more liberal, and they are because there are large proportions of African Americans. But what we wanted to do is actually tease this out for whites, because we thought, you know, that those are the people for which we think that this kind of mechanism, this kind of path, the behavioral path dependence could really act. And so, yeah, so a lot of what we do in the paper and the book is trying to figure out, you know, how can we find this out for white folks in the South? And, you know, we do that in a couple of different ways. One is to get relatively recent big surveys that ask a lot of questions of a lot of people so that we can get huge over samples of Southern whites to kind of really get a sense for the geographic dispersion of their attitudes. And we also use election outcome data, election kind of vote data, and combine it with some data from the voter file in terms of turnout by race, which you can get in the South, or you could get in the South when the Voting Rights Act was still working. And you can use that information to kind of back out what you think the white vote is in these areas. And so that's kind of helped us. So we're really focusing on white folks. And so we're the kind of idea is that some of these families that have passed down these things over time, are because throughout the generations, at least among white people in the South.
So if I understand you correctly, it's possible, and it's actually fairly consistent that you have some of these areas that are the bluest areas, you know, on a county level in the South, have some of the most racist white voters. Is that do I understand that correctly?
Yeah, I would say that's a fair characterization of what we're saying. And I think partly it's instructive to kind of think about, you know, one thing that's always kind of helped me is when, you know, you think about places like, you know, we think of West Virginia, and West Virginia is kind of like, you know, border South, left Virginia because of the Civil War and things like that, but is a useful comparison sometimes. Think about in the minds of most Americans, we think of West Virginia as being so solidly red that, you know, just deep, deep red, very Republican. And we kind of compare that to a place like to Georgia or Mississippi or Alabama, which we do also think of as being pretty red, but with a kind of blue streaks, literal blue streaks. But also, you know, there are Democratic representatives from those states. And I think we tend to think we I don't know if we equate them, but I think what we don't realize is actually, if you were to just take all the white people in Mississippi and Alabama and compare them to the white people in West Virginia, I think what you'd find is that that they're actually a lot more liberal or they're more liberal in West Virginia than they are in Alabama and Mississippi. And you can actually, going back in history, you can see that where West Virginia was an area that actually had, when there was the solid South of Democrats, you know, West Virginia actually elected Republican governors, more liberal Republican governors. And so it's an interesting, you know, I think sometimes these kind of old populations of people tend to mask the kind of underlying individual level variation in attitudes that is pretty interesting. And I think especially that's true about the way that race masks kind of white, you know, the differences among races can mask some of the white conservatism in the South.
So wait a second. So that is, the individual white voters in West Virginia are less racist than those pockets of white voters in those other states you mentioned. So why does that translate? So is in that instance in West Virginia, is it that their conservative views are not a function of race? Is that I'm hung up on that.
Yeah, so part of it is that I think we just don't see it because, you know, we never get an election where just everyone and only the white, you know, not anymore. We don't get elections where everyone, you know, only the white people vote in Mississippi or Alabama. You know, whereas that is basically, you know, given the demographics of West Virginia, that's what every election is in West Virginia. And so I think if you were to hold an election where only white people could vote, right, and we gave them, you know, we would see that West Virginia, I think, would generally tend to be slightly more liberal on a lot of set of issues than like the white folks in Alabama.
Slightly more liberal or less conservative?
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly. So, I mean, this is all like relative degrees. And
okay.
So it's not like we're not talking about, it's, you know, it's not going to be, you know, obviously West Virginia is not like, you know, Massachusetts or something like that, or even New Hampshire, but it's going to be relatively less conservative than these other areas. And I think, you know, to some extent, you kind of see that in some of the politics coming out of places like West Virginia. It tend to be, you know, they do tend to, there's, I think, more kind of toying with or entertaining liberal ideas when it comes to, say, unions and things like that than we really see in the Deep South.
But West Virginia, now, has West Virginia become more conservative over time? I'm getting confused with sort of just like partisan realignment, A is a question. And B, if it is the case, does this mean that race is not exclusively the most predominant factor in determining how conservative, broadly speaking, a population would be?
Yeah, I think that's an important distinction, and it kind of helps with the West Virginia case too. Because one thing we do find is we found in our previous research is the following, which is that if you look at areas of the South that had legalized, you know, had allowed slavery, it was legal, but had very little slavery itself. You know, these are kind of places along the northern border states, places like West Virginia. And you match them up with similarly rural areas just on the other side of the border and then in the kind of quote-unquote north, so places in southern Ohio, Indiana, places like that, what you find is actually very little difference in the attitudes that we see between those two areas, right? And that suggests that that can mean a couple of different things. That means certainly it's the case that, you know, at least we can't, you know, 100% of the variation in conservative attitude is obviously not due to something like slavery. And that could be for a number of reasons. It could be because there is like a significant other part of conservatism that is just part of the belief structure that drives people to be conservative or other kind of life experiences. It could also be that their geographic mobility in the country has made this trying to tease these two things out very difficult, right? A lot of black and white people moved out of the South in the first half of the 20th century during the Great Migration to places in the North and places in the West. So we did have big exoduses of both black and white folks that could kind of, in some sense, if you think about those kind of, those are now spilling over into other areas. And so it becomes harder over time to kind of see these relationships. They tend to attenuate over time just because you have people moving like that. And so it's hard to tease those two things apart. It could still be the case that a lot of this is being driven by race. It's just kind of indirectly through people moving, but we can't quite tease it out without getting a full accounting of everyone's family history. And that's obviously very difficult.
Right. So the idea is that, getting back to the Reconstruction era, when you had a county that had a high proportion of slavery or of slaves, essentially to white folk, the responses were basically to subjugate black people who are now free economically, politically. This goes on through, through the Jim Crow era. And so the idea is that theoretically the lessons that are learned, I mean, as you know, hey, Pa, why is it there's a poll tax? Well, I'll tell you, son, like these ideas are then communicated and embedded in this next generation. And they retain these ideas, essentially. Right. And even if they move to West Virginia, they still have these ideas, even if those measures aren't there, or they implement those measures there for reasons maybe that they have forgotten or were never firsthand experienced as to why they were doing this.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, one thing that is always for us is somewhat humbling about doing research like this is that I think it makes you question a little bit to the degree to which you've come to your own beliefs as like a true rational person, where you sat down and really thought about all the alternatives and decided that, you know, my political beliefs are directly a function of that rationality. I think that's how all of us like to perceive ourselves. But really when it comes down to it, a lot of it is being shaped by our family history and our upbringing in various ways. And I think definitely in the South, you saw there are some really kind of amazing descriptions of this in what is now called kind of a racial etiquette, in the way that children were raised in a way that kind of follow rules of interacting with members of the opposite race. In the South, it was highly codified, informally. It wasn't always legal, but there would be strict rules about, say, when a young white child was walking on a sidewalk and a black adult approached them, who would get out of the way, right? And who had the right of way in that situation? It was always the young white child, and there were certain ways that young white children were allowed to talk to adult African Americans. And these kinds of structures were heavily enforced, right? Along with things like, children's versions of things like the KKK, clubs that kids would join as part of this. And all of these kinds of these infrastructure was built up around making sure that, that white and black people understood what the rules were for interacting, and in particular to make sure that everyone understood that African Americans were in a subjugated position relative to whites. Right. And I think that it was overwhelming when you look at kind of the people that have done historical work to figure this out. And it's hard to imagine that a situation like that doesn't color how you view the world moving forward and how maybe you talk about race to your children moving forward. So even if that codification ended in the 19, or became less prominent in the middle part of the 20th century, it could still be the case that, a lot of the people that grew up learning those lessons might still be alive. They might still be voting. So it's. I think that's an important consideration, and one that we think is really important for the results that we find in the book.
And the intensity of the racism is tied directly into the proportion in which that community relied on slave labor, because their reaction, almost like the blowback from emancipation, had to be that much more severe and strong. And so they're constructing sort of more racist social mores because from their perspective, the threat of loss of power was that much greater.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about situations where the local white in a county, the local white population, again, might be outnumbered 9-1. So if you just think about, majority vote, that's a problem for a white population that really saw itself as being the only like responsible group of people to be able to run society. And the idea was that they're, if you read kind of historical accounts and first person historical newspaper accounts of the white reaction to emancipation, it was very dramatic. I mean, they were obsessed with the kind of labor problems that were going to come down the road for them. They were obsessed with the political issues that were going to come down the road. And so, these were highly localized, right? So that's why we see this kind of local effect.
How do you measure the intensity of racism, relative to, let's say, an area? And we should say the area follows the Black Belt, which is literally a description of very fertile soil that allowed for the growing of cotton and maybe other commodities that would require a higher rate of slavery within that area. So it's sort of I guess, we see this in the context of other, if you're in thousands of years ago living in a fertile area, agriculture becomes your primary, the agriculture becomes the primary driver and society is constructed around that. That notion exists. And so it makes that sense. But how do you measure through time the relative levels of racism from a county that, say, had 9-1 ratio versus, let's say, 5-5 or, 7-3?
Yeah, I think for us, that was one of the most challenging things about the book. And one of the reasons why we decided to write a book was because we thought, part of it is kind of data, data detective work, trying to find the little bits of quantitative evidence that we could get from whatever source. So it looks like different things in different time periods. So, you know, when we had to look about a little bit about this in the antebellum period, and there we were looking at how different members of the Georgia state legislature voted, and how did the ones that lived in the kind of high slave areas vote compared to the low slave areas. We looked at how, in kind of moving forward in more of the Jim Crow area, we were looking at how did counties, when ratification of Jim Crow state constitutions, particularly we looked at Alabama, were up for a vote in to ratify the constitution that was explicitly about restricting the kind of ability of disenfranchising African Americans, putting all the kind of Jim Crow era laws on them. And we looked at, you know, how did the counties vote for this, and we find that, you know, the areas at higher levels of slavery were more likely to vote for to ratify the constitutional amendment that would disenfranchise African Americans. Later on, we got data on lynchings over the course of the kind of late 19th, early 20th century, and found that as a proportion of the total number of people, there were more lynchings of African Americans in these areas relative to the low slave areas. And then moving kind of, you know, steadily moving forward in time, we can use once the disenfranchisement of African Americans is complete, we can actually use just the vote shares in these areas because those are just basically white elections. And so we can look at how they voted in terms of national elections in that time period. And then fast forwarding, you know, over time to today, we can start to look at things like big surveys that are being done by the National Election Survey, done by political scientists in Michigan, and then the another survey that's now kind of even bigger. And we can look at questions that specifically ask people things like, you know, how warmly do you feel about this group, you know, on a scale from 0 to 100? And ask about, you know, what do you think about black people? What do you think about white people? And we can look at just the difference between those two numbers as a measure of kind of racial preference.
Wow.
And then today, I mean, now there's political science is trying to get very sophisticated about how it measures kind of views on race that don't necessarily, that are kind of more, say, hidden than the kind of obvious racism of the biological racism of the past. And so we use some of those kind of more subtle measures in the current time period in these surveys in the last few years. But I mean, it's just, for us, it was all about, you know, where could we get the different data sources to piece it together to kind of to try to trace this out over time, because there's no one data source.
No one was taking the poll for of the past 200 years. What are your attitudes towards?
Right, it would be great if the census should have asked this, but they did not. So we had to rely on just kind of finding things as we went.
Okay, so I have two sort of, I guess, major questions to ask you left. One is the persistence. So, I mean, you've talked about, you can, and you said earlier, like, you know, you could see that this is linear. Like, you can follow the trajectory of this. And I imagine, you know, when you say that you can measure the incidence of lynchings, and I would presume probably to the extent that that data is available, you know, in the 20s, it may have been a little bit more public or at least, you know, newspaper reports, like the incidence or the size of the Klan in a specific area. I would imagine that in and of itself provides the durability, like each era provides its own sort of reproduction machine of these attitudes. Is that the case? And B, if it is the case, are there areas where that falls off? Like, is there nothing that can then break that other than sort of distance, you know, generational distance from that slavery?
Yeah. So, I mean, we try to take this up a little bit. It's a tough question. Like, how did, you know, what is the, you know, like one, someone asked us once very early on when we were writing this, like, what's the half-life, you know, the kind of radioactive half-life of this? Like, when should we expect this to kind of go away? And so we try to look at that a little bit, and it's a difficult question just because it's hard to compare some of these measures over time. But one thing we do see is that when we look at things that are outcome measures where we see that the federal government has really gotten involved, and take an action, where things like voting rights, things like kind of educational inequalities, things like even income inequalities, what we see is that those types of measures, the kind of black-white wage gap, the black-white education gap, and the black-white kind of turnout gap, those things used to be really heavily correlated with slavery back in the early part of the 20th century. Right, so it's kind of the same story we've been telling about these things, that you saw this both in terms of attitudes, but also in terms of the kind of inequalities between whites and blacks. Now, even though those inequalities still exist between blacks and whites, but they're actually much, much less correlated with slavery than they were in the 1940s. Right, and so that speaks to the fact that part of what happened was that the federal government actually went in and had some really big interventions, things like the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act in the 1960s, actually had a big impact on kind of flattening the relation, the kind of how local some of these effects are on some of these outcomes, right? And so that's, we see that as like an interesting, I don't know if a success, but an interesting kind of way that when the federal government actually got involved and did something, it actually had a pretty big impact. What we don't see that on is things like these attitudes. The relationships that we see between slavery and attitudes in the middle part of the 20th century are not that different than the attitudes, the relationship between attitudes and slavery that we see in the early part of the 21st century. And to some extent, that we think that kind of speaks to this idea that it's hard to change the kind of hearts and minds, and we don't really know what that's going to look like moving forward. And so we'd like, you know, it could be the case that these things just kind of march and get kind of, they dissipate slowly and slowly and slowly. But on the other hand, it could be the case that kind of entrepreneurial politicians are able to kind of latch on to some of these political divisions and actually kind of reactivate them in some ways. And I think it's hard to know how that lasts. I mean, to just give you a sense of how long...
That's sort of terrifying in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, to give you an example of this...
So if I understand you, just to restate, federal intervention is a fairly effective means in which to make some material differences, and presumably in the worst case scenarios, right? Because that's where you're most likely affair. But in terms, but despite these material differences, attitudes have a persistence that is incredible. It seems like, and that persistence and that durability is also a function of people out there who know that it's latent and at any time can sort of re-up its virulence.
Yeah, and so I think that's totally correct. And I think one, you know, outside of the context of the South, one thing, you know, we one piece of literature, a paper in economics that showed that they related voting for the Nazi Party in Germany in the 20th century was related to the Black Death era pogroms and anti-Semitism, like, you know, in the 12th century, right? Hundreds of years of persistence. And again, that kind of shows you, I think what's interesting about that example is not only is it like not, we don't necessarily have this thing where just everything goes away, but it could be that there are, you know, again, kind of entrepreneurial politicians that can take advantage of these kinds of divisions and reignite them. And I think that's something that, you know, we tend to think of everything as progress is marching forward and things like that. But I do think that it doesn't, you know, there are ways that it could go in different directions. And I think that's something to watch out for as time marches on.
Okay. My last question for you is, largely outside of your portfolio, I think, but seems to me to be highly implicated in your research. What about the converse? Like, what about those areas where you had a 9-to-1 slave to, you know, a slave owner, more or less? What were the implications if the attitudes that were so ingrained, that are so, were developed then in response to emancipation and presumably slavery, right? I mean, to justify it, these are they're two sides of the same coin. Are so durable in white people. What about the attitudes that would have necessarily come with being subjugated in black people?
Yeah, we've looked at this a little bit, but I mean, one issue that we've kind of faced with studying kind of African-American views on this and kind of how we think there's obviously a huge legacy of slavery for African-Americans. I think, but the thing that makes it difficult to study for us is that, you know, for white folks, we can actually, the people, you know, had
Right. They could vote. They did things in society which would indicate their attitudes. And black people, largely during that period, have no ability to articulate that in the public record.
Right. Well, not just that, but there's a variety of ways that whites could interact with society, and variety of ways that they could interact with the slavery and the issues of post emancipation. Whereas African Americans had basically uniformly treated by these institutions, right? Basically, you know, massive proportions were enslaved. You know, so it's not like there was a big group of African Americans that were not enslaved that we could look at. Oh, how did their attitudes form over time if they didn't interact with slavery? Whereas with white folks, we definitely have these areas where they just didn't interact with slavery all that much. And so there's more. We think that the impact on African Americans was so overwhelming that it makes it actually difficult to kind of study, because it's hard to figure out what would have it looked like for them if this institution didn't exist. I mean, that's almost like a crazy question to even wrap your head around. And I think that's what makes it a difficult thing to study. Having said that, I think, you know, there is evidence that African-Americans have higher degrees of what's called linked fate, where they tend to think about what's good for the group is good for me in terms of the descriptive representation and things like that. And we think that could be in part driven by this kind of interaction, the way of being subjugated in this way, in this manner, definitely seems like something that could lead to those kinds of attitudes over a long period of time.
At the very least, your research shows that the legacy of slavery, particularly how it impacts individual attitudes, has an incredible amount of durability.
Yeah. We were surprised, and we kind of threw the kitchen sink at it, and it's still there. And so it's definitely something that we were surprised by to some extent. I mean, it's hard. Sometimes we feel surprised by it, and sometimes we feel like it's just completely obvious. So it's just hard to balance those two ideas. It's such an important institution, but 250 years, you know, it's just hard to wrap your head around that.
Matthew Blackwell, the book is Deep Roots, How Slavery Still Shapes Southern Politics, and I guess if you had room, American politics. We will put a link to that at MajorityReportRadio.com. Thanks so much for your time today. Really fascinating.
All right. Thank you so much for this.